Good evening, my dear brethren and sisters and young people. You'll remember on our last occasion that we left young Josiah having made a commitment. Despite the environment that was all around him, which was pulling in every other way but in godly ways, and despite the terrible legacy that he had from his father and his grandfather in the 50 plus years that preceded him, Josiah, at the age of 16, began to beat a path, as the word seek there in verse 3 of this chapter that we've read now really means. He began to beat a path and to seek by searching out. You know, that's talking about forming habits, good habits. And that's what he started to do well before the time that he was 16. So that by the time he had reached that age, he was already on the way to forming godly habits in his life. Habits of mind, habits of thinking. Young people, never underestimate the importance of beating a path in your mind and developing pathways of godly thinking. And don't allow your minds to be distracted by a myriad and one other things that are in this world that'll just start to form other pathways in your mind that you'll wish later in life that you could get rid of and you'll never be able to get rid of. Josiah at 16 began to beat godly paths in his mind and in his way of life, in his practice as well. You know, that term, he began to seek after or beat a path, does not describe an occasional, casual, superficial interest in the Bible. It's talking about real, earnest focus every day. It would have required on his part great diligence and regularity. You know, that's something that young people growing up in this age and children growing up in this age and to some degree the adults in the Western world are not really very good at. Maintaining regularity. It required on the part of young Josiah a commitment and self-discipline that was sustained. If he was ever going to make a habit, you've got to stick at something. And that's what he was prepared to do. And young people, he was only 16 years old. I know there's some 16-year-olds here tonight. There's some a little younger and there's some a little older. But how do we all fare with this, brethren and sisters and young people? How do we compare with the spirit of this man, at young man, at only 16 years of age? I'd like you to come across to Proverbs chapter 2 for a moment, because what he had done is developed at this very early age of his life the spirit that the wise man was talking about in Proverbs chapter 2. And in chapter 2 of Proverbs, and I have no doubt in my mind that the Proverbs of Solomon were available in the palace, and it must have been one of the sources that he had gone to frequently for instruction and had been prepared to listen to, both from the mouths of those older ones around him and also for himself as he read. Verse 1 says, "My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest her as for hid treasure, then thou shalt understand the fear of Yahweh and shall find the knowledge of God. Then," there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 verbs, all describing an intensity of effort and seeking and earnestness, crying after, inclining your ears, and then you'll find. And you can imagine this young boy, before he even got to the age of 16, reading these words and understanding the wisdom of his great-great-great-grandfather Solomon. Then you will understand the fear of Yahweh and find the knowledge of God. For, it goes on to say in verse 6, Yahweh giveth wisdom. Out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keepeth the paths of judgment and preserveth the way of his saints. Then shalt thou understand righteousness and judgment and equity, yea, every good path. And here he is beating a path, brethren and sisters. And did you notice in verses 6 to 9, Solomon here is talking about beating two kinds of paths. I wonder whether you noticed it. He's talking about beating paths of the mind and paths of action. Paths in terms of a way of life. And it's not him that would be doing it solely, because if he was able to generate the spirit of verses 1 to 4, then God would start to work. God would give wisdom. And out of his mouth would come knowledge. And he would keep his paths. And you know, young Josiah understood that at the age of 16. Young people, listen to those words and take them into your lives. Because if we are prepared to put our energies and our efforts now in the time of our youth, God will richly pour out a blessing that we can scarcely understand. And it will develop in us pathways of godliness in thinking and in practice. You know, it's God only rewards those who diligently seek with a singleness of mind. He doesn't reward intelligence, brethren and sisters. Some of us may be more intelligent than others, but that's not what God adds his blessing to. God adds his blessing abundantly to energy and single-mindedness. And the lives of those who have so directed their paths and their thinking will be evidently seen to be in the hands of God. And there's the key to Josiah's success. It's all very obvious, isn't it, brethren and sisters and young people? A single-minded focus, an interest in divine things that's seen every day, not just on Saturdays when there's young folks, or on a Friday night when there's youth group, or on a Sunday. But you know, as well as I do, that in some circles, it's cool to be disinterested in the truth. It's cool, even in young people's, Christadelphian young people's circles. Sometimes it's cool to show as little interest as you possibly can. To keep your Bibles closed sometimes during a talk. To never even attempt to pick up a pencil. To never really look terribly interested and to watch the clock the whole time to wait till it's over. This is not Josiah. Josiah has a different spirit to that. That's the spirit of this age that just doesn't want anything to do with godliness. But this lad at 16 was beating a path. Young people, brethren and sisters, can I make an appeal to you to actually pick up a pencil and make some notes? It's not because I'm going to say anything very profound tonight, but it's because as soon as you put a pencil in your hand and put pencil to paper, your mind goes into gear. We are a passive generation largely, and we don't put our minds into gear often enough. And as soon as we have to write something, our minds automatically go into gear. So it's a very wise habit to get into, young people, to do. You know, the summary at the end of Josiah's life that we looked at briefly last time, I'd like to come back to that now. 2 Kings chapter 23. And while you're turning that up, if you've got it already, 2 Kings 23, you can find the little piece of paper that you were given when you came in. And some of you might not have had a lot of time to do your little exercise, but I hope some of you have. We find in 2 Kings 23 and at verse 25, this summary statement of Josiah's life, and like unto him was there no king before him that turned to Yahweh with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, neither after him arose there any like him. You know, that's really the spirit of those words in Proverbs, isn't it? Turning to Yahweh with all his heart and all his soul and all his might. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that those words are never, ever said to apply in the whole realm of Scripture to anyone else but Josiah? That's not to say that there were not others who did show the same spirit, but he is the only man in the entire realm of Scripture of whom those words are said. And they occur in, well, two major places. These words, to serve with all, or to turn with all the heart and all the soul and all the might, are a citation from the past. Can anyone tell me where it comes from? Come on, there must be lots of people with something written on their piece of paper there somewhere. You can call out from the middle. Beg your pardon? Deuteronomy 6 verse 5. So if you didn't actually find that on your little piece of paper, which, by the way, has to go back into your pocket or into your Bible and not on the floor afterwards, the first blank space is Deuteronomy 6 verse 5. Let's go there, please. Just hold your hand, or put your little piece of paper in Kings, and let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Just for a moment. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4 begins the great Shema. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God is one Yahweh, and thou shalt love Yahweh thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. You see, verse 5, in fact, brothers and sisters and young people, is really based on verse 4. It's a natural consequence of verse 4. Because there was only one God, then Israel were called upon to love him with all their heart, soul, and might. Because there were no other gods, there was not a diversity that they could put their trust in. They didn't have to split their allegiance, their affection, their love between any others, and they could therefore devote all of their love towards this one God who had done all things for them. And they were therefore to love him with all their heart and all their soul and all their might. You know, that's a summary statement of what God really wanted from Israel in the past and Israel from that time forward. Because here in Deuteronomy, Moses picks up the very essence of the law and says that what God really wanted is not all their offerings and not all the ritual, but that they might love him with all their heart, all their soul, and all their might. And here's a young lad at 16 years of age who starts with that spirit at that age, continues it all his life, and has the divine stamp of approval but put on his life at the end of it. And he never ever started knowing those words. Because I don't believe that he had the book of Deuteronomy. Whether he had any other books of the law, it's very evident that he had not heard the words of the book of Deuteronomy until the 18th year of his reign, when he was 26. And yet he's already found the spirit of what God really wanted. You know, Jesus picks that up later, and the other passages where it says it's this verse, Deuteronomy 6 verse 5, is actually quoted in the New Testament. It's quoted on a few occasions. It's quoted in Mark 12 verse 30 and 33, it's quoted in Matthew 22, verse 37. And on a completely different occasion, those two that I just mentioned were the same occasion in different gospel records. But there is another occasion in Luke 10 and verse 27. And the essence of Jesus' words when he was discussing that with the scribe was to say that this really, this statement here in verse 5, to love Yahweh thy God with all thy heart, soul, and might, and thy neighbour as thyself, was the essence of the law and the prophets all put together. There was the distillation of all that God really wanted men to do. And here we've got a young lad that sees that without the law. He didn't have a Bible at this stage. And he sets his the direction of his life in such a way that the divine stamp of approval comes down on him with those words and with no one else in all of Holy Writ. Well, come back to Chronicles now, the second of Chronicles. That little piece of paper might be useful because in a few occasions we'll be going backwards and forwards from the Chronicles record, second of Chronicles 34, so you might like to leave it and use it there. Second of Chronicles 34 and at verse 8, we know that this searching that he was undergoing here to seek the God of David his father actually paid off, because we find in verse at the end of verse 8 that he sent these men who were in his court to repair the house of Yahweh his God. His God. This God that he was seeking early in his life came truly to be his own God. Well, where did his inspiration come from? We've already said it. He may have had access to the Proverbs and many other writings, no doubt, of David and of other prophets that were left in the courts of the kings. But I think we're given a hint in verse 3, in the middle of verse 3, when it tells us that he began to seek after the God of David, his father. That's a very unusual title. It's in fact only used on two occasions in the Old Testament, the God of David. You might have thought that it would have been more common than that, but the God of David, his father, is a title of God that's just not used very often at all. The two occasions, if you are taking notes, and I'm only going to do it quickly, are 2 Chronicles 21 and verse 12, and the second one is in 2 Kings 20 and verse 5. Now, there is another passage in Isaiah, but it's the same as the Chronicles record. Oh, sorry, as the King's record, it's the parallel record. So there are really only two occasions. Now, the first of those is a denunciation of Jehoram, the king, for disgracing the lineage of David. Absolute disgrace. He's described as a king of Israel, not a king of Judah, and he didn't deserve to be in the line of David, and he was going to be taken out of the way. That's how he was addressed, as the God of David, his father, was going to say this to him, and he didn't belong to that line, and he was going to be taken out of the way. And the other occasion is in the life of Hezekiah, where Yahweh answers Hezekiah's prayer at the time of his sickness, and Isaiah comes back and tells him that he will be saved from his sickness, he's going to be healed, and his lineage is restored. And we know that Hezekiah was most concerned about the line of David and the lineage of David continuing. So this little phrase, the God of David, his father, is really underlining the spiritual heritage of David. And that's what Josiah was so deeply concerned about. You know, David became the measuring stick of all the kings of Judah. Nearly all the kings are measured up alongside of him as to whether they walked in his ways or they didn't. And Josiah, no doubt, had read many of the records of the palaces. The scribes had recorded these, and he would have had access to those and read them. Not only that, I believe he must have had access to many of the Psalms as well, in which he would have read about the courage and the faith, about the godliness of David, about the spirit of David, and of the wonderful promises that God had actually given to him. And he wanted to know that God that had inspired David and worked in his life and done so many marvelous things, because David, he came to understand, was a man after God's own heart. And he wanted so desperately to be like him. You know, in the end, he turned out just like David. And the divine record says so in verse 2. He walked in all the ways of David his father and declined neither to the right hand or the left. So focused was he on all that David had said and written, so concerned was he with that great forebear of his, that he had become a mentor to him, I believe. It's almost like a hero in his life, and that he always wanted to be compared to David and tried very hard in his life to consciously see what David would have done. And remember that he didn't have Messiah behind him. Messiah was yet in front. And he only had great men of the past that he could rely on and look to as great examples. And who greater than David could he have modeled his life on? You know, how many of us young people have got a hero? Someone that we actually model our lives on, that we really, really idolize in that sense. That's from the Bible. Do you have a hero from the Bible? Do you have someone that you really want to be like? Well, Josiah did. And he picked the very, very highest example. He picked a man whom God said, he thinks like me. He's got a heart that I'm in tune with. And that's the man that Josiah wanted to come to know. And more importantly, he wanted to come to know the God that had so inspired David through his early years. You know, all around us, people have idols, have cults that they follow, cult heroes of sport and music. And you go into teenagers' rooms many times in the world, and there'll be posters plastered all around about all their heroes, corrupt, depraved people that no one would ever want to base their life on. But here's a young man that's got David as his mentor. You know, if we seek, just like he sought, the God of David, his father, we'll not only find him and come to understand the God of David, but you know, young people, we'll do what Josiah did. Because he came to be like Yahweh. I'd like you to come to Jeremiah chapter 9. Now you remember that Jeremiah is contemporary with Josiah. And Jeremiah chapter 9, in the early part of that chapter, we read in verse 3, Jeremiah, almost exasperated with the state of the nation in which he found himself. And many of the early chapters of Jeremiah were written either in the time of Josiah or in the time of soon after his death. He says in verse 3, "And they bend their tongues like their bows for lies. But they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me." So here, two things are put together. Those who are dishonest and telling lies and proceed from evil to evil don't know God. They might have known something about Yahweh, but they don't know me, says God. Let's move on to verse 5. "And they will deceive everyone his neighbor, and they will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies, and they weary themselves to commit iniquity. Thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith Yahweh." This was the people that he was dealing with. These are the contemporaries of Josiah. But turn the page to verse 23. "Thus saith Yahweh, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, nor the rich man in glory in his riches. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am Yahweh, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith Yahweh." You see, what that's saying is that knowing God is not the same as knowing about God. As Brother John Carter once put it, to know God is the completion of the process that starts or begins now with the knowledge of God. We begin by knowing about God, but in the end, our knowledge of God should so begin to change us that we become like him. So knowing God, in fact, is being like him. Knowing God is thinking and acting like him, or manifesting his his character. Now, we've just read... It's not going to stay there. We've seen it now, haven't we? We've seen in Jeremiah 9, verse 24, that Yahweh says that he himself exercises loving kindness, judgment and righteousness. The very things that the people in Jeremiah's day were not prepared to do, their honesty and their deceit, dishonesty and their deceit and all their other iniquities had meant they couldn't ever come to really know in the fullest sense who Yahweh was. I'd like you to come over to chapter 22 because here we're told that Jeremiah did actually come to know Yahweh. In Jeremiah chapter 22, and let's start from verse 13, and it's a little ahead of where we want to be, but it picks up the context, and it's talking about Jehoiakim, his own son. And it says in verse 13, "Woe unto him," the prophet says, "of Jehoiakim, that buildeth his house by unrighteousness, and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbour's service without wages, that giveth him not for his work, that saith, I will build me a wide house and a large chambers, and cutteth him out windows, and it is sealed with cedar and painted with vermilion." The prophet goes on to say, "Shalt thou reign, Jehoiakim, because thou closest thyself in cedar? Did not thy father Josiah eat and drink and do judgment and justice? And then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well with him. It was not this to know me, saith Yahweh. But thine eyes, Jehoiakim, thine eyes and thine heart are not but for thy covetousness, and for to shed innocent blood, and for oppression and violence to do it." Ah, Jehoiakim was cast out. He was going to be thrown over the city wall. Because not only had he not known Yahweh, he'd disgraced the Lion of David. You see, Josiah here is said to have done judgment and justice and to judge the cause of the poor and needy. Did you notice the simplicity of Josiah's life here too in verse 5? Did not thy father eat and drink? As opposed to, that's in verse 15, as opposed to Jehoiakim who built himself great palaces and fitted them out with every luxury he could ever have. In contrast to that, Josiah, it appears, lived a simple life. He was content with food and drink and to do judgment and justice because from an early age he'd learned to beat a path in righteousness that had allowed him to come to know in the very real sense who Yahweh was. And when we have a look at this chart, it's very interesting. You've got to look at the colours, because the word that we find in Jeremiah chapter 9 and that for exercises, Yahweh exercises, is exactly the same word in Hebrew, in the Hebrew, as in Jeremiah 22 that's rendered here, do. He did judgment and justice. This is what Josiah did. So Josiah was actually exercising judgment and justice. Now, it doesn't actually seem to be the same characteristics, but you know in the Hebrew, these words are the same in these two places. And on that chart, where the words are actually coloured in, they're the same. For example, judgment is in fact the same word in the two passages. Righteousness and justice in those two passages is exactly the same Hebrew word, but translated differently in English. So there's two of the characteristics that map out what Yahweh is really like, because Yahweh himself said, "I am he that exercises loving kindness, judgment and righteousness in the earth, and at these things I delight." Now, Yahweh doesn't actually come down on earth and walk around amongst men. The way he exercises those characteristics is through individual people who've come to understand him and are prepared to manifest those same characteristics. And those people have come to know him. And they are his representatives on earth. And now Josiah, by the prophet Jeremiah, is said to exercise judgment and righteousness and the loving kindness seems to be missing. But it does say in Jeremiah chapter 22 that he judged the cause of the poor and needy, which we might interpret as being the loving kindness quality of God. We don't even have to guess, because if you come back to 2 Chronicles chapter 35, the picture is complete. 2 Chronicles chapter 35. We have a statement right at the end of Josiah's life that so neatly finishes the picture. In verse 26 of 2 Chronicles 35. Now, the rest of the acts of Josiah and his goodness according to all that was written in the law of Yahweh and his deeds, etc., first and last, they are written in the books of the kings. In verse 26, you might notice in the margin, if you have an Oxford Bible, alongside the word goodness, kindnesses. It is exactly the same word in Hebrew as loving kindness. It's the Hebrew word chesed. In fact, it's in the plural here. And Josiah was noted at the end of his life for his loving kindnesses that had been shown in the nation, as well as by Jeremiah noted for his righteousness and his judgment. And all three characteristics are said to be those which belong to Yahweh in himself and who he exercises, which are exercised through those who have actually truly come to know him. The end of his life, he goes down in the divine record, therefore, brethren and sisters, as a man that not only sought and found the God of David, but whose character was impressed with that of Yahweh himself. He was a manifestation of the divine character that God himself was pleased to be associated with for all time, and will yet rise to do a great work in the future. You know, truly, brethren and sisters and young people, we have a mighty man here whose life we really need to come to grips with and to measure ourselves by. Well, turn back a page and come to the middle of verse 3 of chapter 34, because now the purge begins. This was, in fact, 4 years after the first statement that he had set his path to walk in godly ways. And we find in the middle of verse 3, in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and the carved images and the molten images. And so at the age of 20, he begins this, initiates this purge or cleansing, as the word really means, facing what must have seemed an almost impossible task. But it didn't deter him. And with only relatively few supporters, and knowing also that the majority of the nation still would have been much happier to go in the way of Ammon and of Manasseh in his earlier days. You know, it's fairly clear that he must have been planning this for some time. The way it was carried out indicates that it couldn't have just been a knee-jerk reaction. But why on earth start the active part of your reign with a purge? It was hardly the most popular move that you could have actually taken. But Josiah, having from an early age begun to beat a path, had understood already what Deuteronomy 6 verse 4 and 5 had said without ever reading them, that there was only one God, and that he could never ever serve that one God while there were other imitations, and while there were other distractions, while there were other false gods in the process and around. And he saw the idolatry all around that had characterized the reigns, particularly of Manasseh for most of it, and for Ammon during his short reign. He saw that that was his highest priority. He had to remove that first. And so he began with this purge to get rid of the high places and the groves and the carved images from across the land. But I believe also, brethren, sisters and young people, he knew about 1 Kings chapter 13. Because it seems highly likely that the palace records were there. And we would have expected that the books of the kings and possibly other records as well were in his possession. And I'd like you to come back to 1 Kings. Just hold, put your little piece of paper in 2 Chronicles. Come back to 1 Kings chapter 13. Because in 1 Kings 13, Josiah is named. He's one of the few men in all of history who are named before their birth. And he's no question here in the record, a child of promise with a very special mission. And it may well have been that Hilkiah and Shaphan and other faithfuls had come across this in the records of the palace and had tried to encourage his ways in godliness in order that he might eventually have the right spirit to fulfill the words that are spoken here. But the context in which we find these words where Josiah's name is mentioned was the apostasy of Jeroboam gaining a foothold. In fact, it was the inaugural ceremony of Jeroboam's feast. Now, Jeroboam's apostasy can be very simply summarized as being a very palatable change to truth. And right at the end of chapter 12 of Kings, you'll notice that all of these four aspects of Jeroboam's apostasy are all listed from about verse 32 to the end of the chapter, of chapter 12. And what he did is basically made just changes to truth. And apostasy and error often is just that. He changed the center of worship. He changed the representation of God. He still called it Yahweh, but said now we're going to have a visual representation of God. He modified the priesthood. He altered the feast times. And he incorporated basically everyone and tried to make it a lot easier for everyone to participate when they wanted, if they wanted to, in the worship. And they didn't have to any longer go down to Jerusalem. And his religion was seen to be much more practical and much less rigid than the worship of Yahweh down at Jerusalem. But it was essentially just man-centered as opposed to God-centered. And at the very critical moment when this ceremony at the feast is just getting underway, and Jeroboam himself, because being a man like he was of a huge ego, he was the presiding person over the whole of this ceremony, and at a very time that he's about to inaugurate this wonderful ceremony that's going to take the place of one of the feasts of Yahweh, behold, we read in verse 1, of chapter 13, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of Yahweh unto Bethel, and Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense, and he cried against the altar in the word of Yahweh and said, O altar, altar, thus saith Yahweh, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name, and upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. And he gave a sign, and the whole stunned audience have their eyes now fixed upon him. And Jeroboam, you can imagine, was absolutely infuriated. And he turns to say, get that man, and his hand just withers in front of him. And he has to appeal to the man of God to heal his hand. What a dramatic situation. That's where Josiah's name, in that context, in the midst of gross apostasy in the nation, it just being inaugurated, that's where his name appears. Is it therefore any wonder that the very first thing we find Josiah doing is moving against the gross apostasy that had been set up by Jeroboam and others, and that had found its way eventually into the southern kingdom as well, and had so infiltrated that nation from top to bottom that now there was hardly a righteous man in the whole of the nation? You know, Josiah was impressed. He must have been impressed by those who read him this story, and as he thought about it as he grew a little older and he contemplated the seriousness and the implications of his name having been prophesied 300 years or more before the actual event was going to come. He must have been impressed by two very serious issues, brethren, sisters and young people. Firstly, that idolatry was such a terrible scourge and such a terrible challenge to the unity of God and to the people's worship of Him that it had to go. That's the first thing that was impressed upon his mind. And the second thing was the seriousness of obeying the word of Yahweh. In this book of 1 Kings chapter 13, the word of Yahweh occurs 10 times as a phrase. There's a huge emphasis on this as this man of God came by the word of Yahweh, and almost every time he opened his mouth he said it was by the word of Yahweh that this was going to actually happen. And then he himself lost his life because he went against the word of Yahweh. It was dramatically outlined, not only in Jeroboam's case, but in the case of the man of God himself, who lost his life as a lion took him. And Josiah set about to reverse every single one of those things. You know, he did in his reign. He changed the center of worship back to the center of the nation. He got rid of the idols and tried to recreate in the people's minds a conception of Yahweh as he really was. He tried to reinstitute the priesthood again, and he put the feasts back in their right place and held the greatest Passover since Samuel's day. You see, he'd read his Bible very carefully, and he knew that the word of Yahweh was serious, and he treated it seriously. But why did he wait until the 12th year of his reign to actually start? Why not get started earlier than this? Why not, as soon as he'd committed himself, why didn't he get his men out there trying to do things? I think there's a few good reasons for that, young people. It was an absolutely massive job. It took nearly 6 years for him to get rid of the idolatry in the nation. And that's not going to be something that could have been done off the cuff, or just take a few men and start going around doing. It had to be very thoroughly planned, and he needed a lot of others to support him in the work, and he needed to gather that support. But you know, I think there's one other very important issue that even Josiah at that young age understood. That really, he had not been on the throne in a responsible fashion for long enough for the nation to take him seriously. And he waited for 4 years planning this day, and in the meantime no one said, "Hey Josiah, what do you think you're doing? You hypocrite, you've got those things in your life too. How come you're knocking our idols down here in Bethel?" No one lifted a finger. Because the one thing they knew about this young king from the time he had formally ascended the throne at 16 until the time that this purge started at age 20, the one thing everybody knew is that he served his God with all his heart and all his soul and all his might. And you could have called Josiah anything under the sun you liked, but you could never, ever have called him a hypocrite. And as soon as he moved and the idols came down, people reluctantly accepted it. You know, young people, the best way to affect change in your friends, in the ecclesia, in your family, is to get your own life right. It's always been God's way. We can talk until the cows come home, and it may never, ever do anything. But if we get our own life right, we are sure to influence others in godly ways. And the systematic cleansing began. It wasn't haphazard, it was very carefully planned. Because he was a man with a mission. And we find in verse 3 that we began there. Began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and the carved images and the molten images. And they break down the altars of Balaam in his presence. Underline that phrase. In his presence. And the images Notice the margin, sun images, that were on high above them. And he cut them down, and the groves, and the carved images, and the molten images. He brake in pieces, and made dust of them, and strode it upon the graves of them that had sacrificed unto them. And he burnt the bones of the priests upon the altars, and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. How did he know to burn the bones of these old priests on the altars? Why would he have actually done that if he'd never ever come across 1 Kings chapter 13? Because that's exactly what 1 Kings 13 said he was going to do. Well, it's a terrible list, isn't it? It's repeated again in verse 7 as he completes the task, and it's this great long list of things that he did. It took him quite some considerable time, and it was a very, very difficult thing to do, to cut these things down. If you have a look, there's just a couple of high places that have been found. One at the top is at Megiddo, and another at Hatzor in the north of Israel. And there have been many others. And they had massive images. Now, some of those images have been broken over time. But even so, what has been found today, imagine breaking this stuff down. It's not no easy task to break those huge stones down. And Josiah was determined not to leave those there. And he was going to pull them apart and grind them to powder. Notice it actually says that he was going to grind it and make dust of them. How long would that have actually taken? It would have been a much more difficult and laborious task to break them right down into small pieces than it would ever have been to build them in the first place. And yet so was the determination of this young man that nothing was going to stand in his way. And you know what? The amazing thing is that he was doing almost exactly what Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 5, it's worth putting in your margin, Deuteronomy 7 verse 5 had said they were to do if any idols were found in the nation. They were to break them down, smash them, burn them if they were wood, and they were to grind them to powder if they were stone. And that's exactly what Josiah did, and he didn't have the book of Deuteronomy. Here's a man that's so in tune with the divine mind, who sees the issues so amazingly clearly, that he actually goes out and starts doing things without any knowledge that God's already previously said this, because his mind is in tune. Oh yes, he may well have had the precedent of other kings like Hezekiah and Asa, who before had done similar things, but even then he had to decide who was right and what sort of action they'd taken and whether in fact it was the appropriate thing to do. You know, he should have thought, well, we just take them out of the way, and if anyone dares put them up, we'll get them later. No, Josiah knew what human nature was like, that unless they were destroyed, they would be up again tomorrow as soon as he turned his back. And you know, he's exactly right. Because when he did turn his back, they came back up again. Not the ones he'd broken down because he ground them to powder, but they actually made new ones when he turned his back. And it was really important that more come on sight to his cause. And we find that 1 year after the purge began, that Jeremiah was commissioned. In the 13th year of his reign, Jeremiah was called. And what a wonderful thing that must have been to see those two young lads. I think Jeremiah must have been about the same age as Josiah, very close to it anyway. And no doubt, if as seems highly likely, that Jeremiah was the son of Hilkiah the high priest, and Hilkiah having had a very powerful influence in the early life of Josiah, these two boys must have grown up almost as brothers and had such a close bond in divine things and saw things so clearly themselves. And now we've got a king and a prophet working amongst the nation, supporting each other, and Josiah's going around with a team of men and pulling things down in his presence. He was no armchair king. He got out there and faced the people. He told them why they were coming down. And Jeremiah was around amongst the people as well, explaining the principles and why they were doing this and what they should be doing and how they should turn to Yahweh. And what a wonderful team that must have been, with other prophets and other faithfuls who joined them in that time. But it's all very well for us to talk about idols coming down in high places and pieces of stone and wood and burning them and crushing them and throwing them down the valley and burning the bones of dead men. Of what relevance has that to us? You know, brothers and sisters, I am absolutely convinced that the really big issue of Josiah's life is idolatry. And we'll return in a later study to that. Because Josiah had to face this issue again. But just for a moment, I think we need to just stop and pause and think. And not just read straight across all this stuff like this. What is an idol? Well, there's lots of words for idol in the Old Testament. I think there's something like 20 different words. But the most common word for idol, it just really means something vain or useless, which is exactly what they were. Just something useless. Useless? They were the most powerful pieces of wood and stone you have ever seen, that just deceived the hearts of men and women and had them transfixed, doing all kinds of things that under normal circumstances they would never have done, or you would have thought they would never have done. Why on earth would anyone bow down to a lump of stone or wood? What's the issue to do with idolatry? Well, when we see all the diverse forms of idolatry that there were in the time of Josiah, Manasseh and Ammon, I think the implication of that is this, that idolatry for all of us is going to take very different forms. And idolatry is not just one image. It may, in the lives of all of us, be very different things. But in Israel, there were some very common elements in idol practice. And they were, amongst others, association with all those things that were pleasurable, enjoyable, and that the flesh actually loved doing. That's the first thing that's common between all of the forms of idol worship. But not only that, the actual images themselves, though powerless in themselves, had a very great power of suggestion. And they reminded the people of all kinds of practices and lifestyle. So the idols were actually associated with lifestyle. And thirdly, because they were visual, they were well and truly able to distract people away from single-mindedness service to Yahweh. And they said, in essence, though they couldn't speak, they said, it's okay to serve us part of the time and Yahweh part of the time and that idol over there part of the time, because they were all there offering their services and everything was there for the taking in it. And as a person roamed their eyes across the countryside, they came across all these things. You know, anything, brothers and sisters, that distracts us from single-minded service to Yahweh is an idol. Anything. That means an idol can be a myriad and one different things in our lives, and that's why idolatry is such a difficult issue to pin, because it keeps jumping. And if we put a spotlight on it too heavily, it starts to hurt a bit, so we move off. That's not really an idol in my life. And no doubt the people of Israel had deceived themselves into thinking that at all, as well. But an idol is anything that diverts our time, our energy, our money, our affection away from God. Now, can you think of any idols in your life? I can think of dozens. You know, in Josiah, the high places, as they were called, they plagued the nation from ever since David's time. These high places, which were set up on the tops of hills, eventually they came into valleys, they came right into towns, right under street corners. They started out there on the high places and under the trees and in the groves, but eventually they became so common that they were actually everywhere. Do you know what a high place is really all about? Okay, it looked like that, but what was it all about? It was just advertising what was going on in there. And some of the pillars and carvings in the trees were very suggestive. They encouraged people to think, I wonder what's up there. They were racy and secretive places. They were enticing. They were mysterious. And behind all of that, there were practices that were absolutely debauched. There was immorality of any and every kind. There were male and female prostitutes associated with almost every high place. There was violence and evil of every kind. And the high places advertised it. Here we are, come and get it. Brothers and sisters, let's not dodge. In our high-tech world, perhaps we haven't got high places like that, we've got high-tech high places. That the wizards of this age, the high-tech wizards and the advertising people of this age, are marvellous at marketing. There is a plethora of gods that they deliver for just very little. And it's got all the same suggestive, racy, secretive, enticing ingredients of the high places in Josiah's day. If the internet is not a potential time-wasting, profitless colossus, I don't know what it is. There may be some good uses of it. There may be some productive uses. But 60 to 80% of the use of the internet is all for the same things that these high places were all about. We've got to be careful, brethren and sisters, that we're not sucked into thinking that some of the high-tech stuff is just the ants' pants of everything in our society. It's actually not. It's the product of evil men's minds. And if you've ever seen any of the computer games around, just beware about letting your children play them. The violence and immorality that's depicted in some of those, the huge time-wasting factor that's associated with them. And what about television? The medium that has, more than anything else, brought about the decline of the Western world in terms of morality in the last 50 years. Unquestionably, people in the world understand that, brothers and sisters and young people. And it glorifies day in, day out. You need this, you need that. Unfaithfulness, sex before marriage, drugs, violence, greed, sin, it's good. Here, look at us. Come and get it. You can sit in your lounge. You don't even have to go out in the cold. Don't let's be deceived, brethren and sisters. We've got our gods. There are shrines out there. There's one down the road here somewhere. 32 cinemas in one complex. You can go from one little sitting to the next and choose anything the heart would like to have. And there'd scarcely be anything that's shown in any of those theatres on any day or night that any single one of us would like to sit alongside our Lord Jesus Christ and watch. And young people, you know as well as I do that there are some in our midst who'll go to a young people's class and visit a movie afterwards. If that's not going to the high places in this age, brothers and sisters, I don't know what is. You know what Josiah did? No one else could see the issues. And he took the courage, got his own life right, and he smashed them down to help his brethren. Now, we don't take our acts literally. It's not our role. We're not the king. But we can do it in our own lives. We can take an axe to our idols, whatever they might be. They don't have to be concrete things. They could be a myriad and one different things, brothers and sisters. But you know, this was not actually Josiah's real focus, do you know? He's such a wonderful man. You come to verse 6. So did he in the cities of Manasseh and Ephraim and Simeon, even unto Naphtali and their mattocks round about. And when he had broken down all their altars and groves and beaten to pieces, he came and cut down all the idols throughout all the land of Israel. He returned unto Jerusalem. He didn't stop at the borders of Judah. You know, Israel in the north had gone into captivity long ago, and some of them had were still remaining there, mixed with other peoples. But you see, In the 14th year of Josiah's reign, 2 years after this purge started, Ashurbanipal, the last of the great kings of Assyria, died. And Assyria's power was no more. It was a power vacuum there. And Josiah moved into the north. Whereas it previously had been a vassal state to Assyria, he now took control because he wanted to save his brethren. This was a man who had the God of David as his God, who had the largeness of heart of David. He wasn't provoked by political ambitions, brethren and sisters. He saw the issues of life and death, and there were his brethren in the north with no shepherd, and he went out there to try and help them. And you know what? Some of them responded. Amazing, isn't it? He went right up to the biggest tribes. He went right up past Galilee. He went right down the south into the regions of Simeon, down there in the Arabah. And everywhere he went, with this thoroughness of this purge. You know, there's some archaeological evidence from Josiah's day. Quite amazing. The ruins at Ein Hatzavah. Ein Hatzavah is down in the territory of Simeon that we hear mentioned here in verse 6. It's down the south, about 50 kilometres south of the Dead Sea. And you'll see here, and it's only a black and white photograph, but you'll see some stones. There's a scale there. The white section is only 1 centimetre. So these stones are sort of not very big. They're actually just stones, not huge rocks or boulders. And under a pile of stones near one of these shrines, one of these high places, are about 70 of these idols, all smashed to pulp, under a huge heap of stones. And they've actually tried to date the pottery and so on in there. And you know what time it comes to? Josiah's time. And the Bible record says he went right down there. He didn't just stay in Jerusalem. You know, in a cave just to the east of the old city of David, just south of the Temple Mount area, in the 1960s, Kathleen Kenyon, the famous archaeologist, found a cave with 1,300 broken images and pulverized pieces of idolatry worship, all in a cave, all stashed away under there. All dating to the time of Josiah. Amazing, isn't it? But Josiah didn't stop there. Verse 8. Now, in the 18th year of his reign, and it took him all this time to clean up the land, 6 years. And he wasn't just concerned with pulling down, as we're going to see. Because if we read this verse carefully, it's going to tell us a great deal about this man. Now, in the 18th year of his reign, when he had purged the land and the house, he sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, and Maaseiah, the governor of the city, and Joah, the son of Jehoahaz, the recorder, to repair the house of Yahweh his God. And when they came to Hilkiah the priest, they delivered the money that was brought into the house of God, which the Levites that kept the doors had gathered of the hand of Manasseh and Ephraim, and all the remnant of Israel, and of Judah, and of Benjamin, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, as that last phrase should be translated. It's translated like that in almost every other translation. It doesn't say they returned to Jerusalem, it just should be, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So he gathered money. Now this is a very interesting thing. Because Josiah was not just interested in destroying and pulling down. Because at the very same time that he's pulling idols down, he's collecting money. He's collecting money for the priesthood and the Levites, because they had no means of support at that stage, because the people weren't paying tithes. The reason they weren't paying tithes is they didn't know what tithes were, because the law had been lost and they hadn't lived by the law or by any godly principles for 50 to 60 years. So he's educating them as he goes around, and he's collecting money. The Levites are coming with him and they're collecting it. And he's collecting it to repair the house. So that the record says when, verse 8, he had purged the land, he sent these men to repair the house of Yahweh using all the money that he had already gathered. You know what that tells us? It tells us that right from the start, he knew what he was going to do. At the age of 20, when he began this purge, brethren and sisters, he had such an amazing spirit and depth of understanding
that he knew that just removing idolatry was not enough, and he was more interested in building the house of God than anything else. So in the process of destroying idols, he was gathering money and getting the people on side and trying to talk to them about the issues and explain to them what the truth was about, so that by the time he got back to Jerusalem, he would have enough money and they'd be able to commence the work of building. Now that's an amazing sense of vision, isn't it? Amazing sense of vision. And he's got all Judah and Jerusalem and all up north, all those tribes up north and those down south that previously part of the old Israelite northern kingdom, contributing at all. You know, he wanted all the nation, brethren and sisters, to find Yahweh. He just didn't want to take something away. He wanted to put something in its place, and he wanted to bring the whole nation back to find the God that he'd found. And you know, it was driven by a real genuine concern for two things. One, for Yahweh's honor, and secondly, for the people themselves. He desperately wanted to get Yahweh back into the center of the nation. And brethren and sisters and young people, we desperately need more Josiahs who can see the big picture. You know, it's all very easy to be critical of all kinds of things in life, in ecclesial life, in our own personal lives, in the lives of others. But it's another thing to have the big picture, to know where we're really going, and to have the conviction and courage to act positively, to pull down in our own lives and to build. And that's what he was like. God wants builders, not destroyers. And that's what this man was, above all else. While he was noted here, it appears he was noted for his pulling down, when the divine stamp of approval comes on this man's life in Jeremiah, it says nothing whatever about pulling down idols. It says he exercised righteousness and judgment and loving kindness. Isn't that a wonderful thing? He's got such a balanced character that he could see that the big issue of the truth was building. Oh, there were plenty of others through all history who could never ever see that. I'd like you to come to Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah 58. The importance of building was often highlighted by many of the prophets, because many of Israel saw the truth as just a set of rules and all negatives all the time. Oh, don't do this, don't do that. Young people never ever see the truth like that. Verse 2, he says, the prophet says, yeah, you seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and that forsook not the ordinances of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice, and they take delight in approaching to God. Verse 3. Wherefore, this is what they say, wherefore have we fasted, they say, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge, God? Behold, says God, in the day of your fast ye find pleasure and exact all your labours. You do everything you want in your fast. Behold, ye fast for strife and debate and to smite with a fist of wickedness. Ye shall not fast as ye do this day to make your voice to be heard on high. Is this such a feast as I've chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast, an acceptable day to Yahweh? God's not interested in all the negatives, brethren and sisters. He's not interested in, as Paul later said, touch not, taste not, handle not, don't do this, don't do that, and if you did all the don'ts, then you were righteous. That's what they thought in Isaiah's day as well. But here's what God was looking for in verse 6. Is not this the fast that I've chosen, says Yahweh? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? And when thou seest the naked, that thou coverest him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? Isn't that all positives, brethren and sisters? And that's what God really wanted here. Verse 10. And if thou draw thy soul to the hungry, and satisfy the afflicted soul, Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness shall be as noonday. And Yahweh shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make thy bones fat. And thou shalt be like a watered garden, a spring of water, whose waters fail not. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. Isn't that Josiah? Isn't that a wonderful spirit? If you're prepared to draw out the soul of the hungry and satisfy the feet, your light shall rise in obscurity like noonday. And that's exactly what it did. Josiah shot to the middle of the heavens and shone this bright light across all of Judah and Israel and any that would be found there. And he was known as a repairer, a restorer of paths to dwell in. That's a powerful lesson from this man's life. And he saw that issue at 20. He saw it in ecclesial life that he wasn't actually going to pull anything down unless he was getting ready to put up something in its place. That's where our focus needs to be, brethren and sisters. We need to be builders and restorers. Just come back to Chronicles for a minute. Because the picture we have in conclusion of Josiah initiating this wonderful time of building and refurbishment of the house of Yahweh is really quite amazing. It's just a refreshing spirit about this man and about all that happened. And some interesting things just to notice as we read it. There's a picture of intense positive activity and cooperation here from verse 10 right through to verse 13. Because this money was just got put into the hand of the workmen who had the oversight of the house, and those workmen gave it to those who did the job, and they paid off for the materials, and nobody took any account of any of that, says the king's record. You know, through these verses 10 through to verse 13, the phrase "house of Yahweh" occurs 7 times. There's a real emphasis on this little phrase, the house of Yahweh, because it loomed so largely in Josiah's thought. It wasn't the idols that he was so concerned about, although they had to be gotten out of the way. It was whether the house of Yahweh would be ready for the people to come to. And 3 times he says it needed to be repaired, verse 8, and twice in verse 10, using 2 different words. You know, Josiah wanted everyone involved in this project, and you'll notice there's one very big difference between the positive work that he was involved in here and the negative work of breaking down the idols, and that's this. That when he was out taking the idols down, brethren, they said they did them in his presence, but when he came back, he offered the money and faithfully gave it to men to do the work. He didn't stand over watching every single thing they did. He wanted to encourage faithfulness and integrity. He wanted to encourage them to show a spirit of cooperation amongst themselves without the king's eye looking over them all the time. They didn't need to be an authority there, and he knew it. And he encouraged the people to work, and they did. And as they worked together, they felt this sense of fellowship, and they drew others in as well, and they worked faithfully. Look at this, verse 12. And the men did the work faithfully. You know, how many people were there in Josiah's day that were faithful when he first came to the throne? Jeremiah was told to run through the streets of Jerusalem, and you won't find a man who does righteousness. But now, because of this man's wonderful example and his spirit and his energy and his positive outgoing attitude, he's got others involved, and they're all prepared to work on the house of Yahweh under his influence and his example. But you know, there's a much deeper and more abiding significance in all of that that we really don't have time to spend much time on tonight. You know, the theme of the house of Yahweh runs right from the earliest books of the Bible right through to the end of Revelation. Because God is interested in a house. God is interested in a house that he is building. Ye also are living stones, said the apostle, built up a spiritual house. And Josiah's actions here were as much concerned with the spiritual house as they were with the literal. Of course he wanted the literal house to be repaired. It was in a very bad state of repair. But it only reflected the spiritual state of the nation, of the house of God spiritually. And he got others, many others involved in that work, so that gradually the spiritual house of the nation was starting brick by brick and plank by plank to be built. Because that's where his heart really lay. He was desperately wanting the people to find God and to develop a spirit in there, which was just so wonderful. And as they built, so the people grew closer to God, to each other. And they learned from Josiah's marvelous example. You know, brethren and sisters, without turning to it, you might like to just take a note of Ephesians chapter 4 and at verse 11 to 16. That's well worth tonight as you go home having a look at and just thinking about some of the spiritual implications and principles in our own lives. But building is all about service. Service is almost a dirty word in today's world. No one wants to do service. No one wants to do anything voluntarily anymore. They always want money. They always want some payment for what they do, otherwise they won't do it. And even children are growing up with that attitude. But you know, what God is really looking for, brothers and sisters, is the spirit of service. The spirit of service in his house that's going to repair and build the house of God. You know, instead of just seeking our own selfish ways, what we've got to do is start looking outside of ourselves and volunteer. Young people, you can volunteer in many ways. I've noticed over the last 5 years at combined functions and ecclesial lunches around the place that it's brethren often in their 40s and 50s and 60s who pack up tables, who move chairs, and the able-bodied 14, 15, 16, 18-year-olds have lost the spirit of service. Try and resurrect it. It's a wonderful characteristic that God delights in because it's the basis for building. Anyone that's going to build has to be a servant, has to serve, because there's a greater master plan that they've got to be working towards. It's not just forging our own little path, making our own name. It's building together with others that we might make the edifice of God something that he'll be pleased. And it's the spirit of our master, is it not, who said that he came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. It was the focus of Josiah's life. It was the focus of our Lord's. We need to be builders. God's given us skills, all of us. Skills that could be used in service to build his house, or could be squandered on self. The choice is ours. But if we take the spirit of this young man, we'll rise up with an enthusiasm and a spirit of real dedication and vision to take the yoke and to be restorers of the paths and repairers of the breach. What have we found? We need to develop good habits of mind and practice daily. That God will bless single-mindedness, single-minded seeking. It ought to be our aim in life to know Yahweh. Because if we never come to know him in the truest sense that Jeremiah speaks of, we will be of no use to him in the day when our Lord stands in the earth again. We need to influence others for good by example of faithfulness and integrity. To be prepared to remove idols from our lives and our minds, and to focus on positive activity and be builders in God's house and learn to serve others and not ourselves.